It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. She's the Dean of International Reporting for NPR, covering everything from the Vatican to Italian politics to the civil war in the former Yugoslavia and so much more. But after 41 years, Silvia Poggioli is leaving NPR. Silvia, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
Many listeners might not know that you were born in Providence, Rhode Island, graduated from Harvard. You did postgrad work at the University of Rome as a Fulbright scholar. Why did you want to study in Rome?
Well, I wanted to go to Rome, and I had studied Italian literature in college, and I wanted to pursue my studies. But the fact is, I actually did not study in Rome because it was 1968. There was a lot of political turmoil that year, like in the United States. And the universities all throughout the country were occupied, so there were no classes. So my education was much more directly with people, with young people, demonstrating in the streets and learning about politics more than literature, straight from day-to-day experience.
Mm-hmm. You covered war extensively, reporting on European reaction to the Gulf War in 91, civil war among the Bosnian Serbs and Croats in the former Yugoslavia. When you report on war, what was your approach in making it more than numbers, more than political policies, that it was also about people?
Because the war essentially was about people. The whole purpose, the whole motivation of those who fomented the war, the warlords, mainly the Serbs both of Serbia and of Bosnia, was to move their rival ethnic groups away, to either kill them or to force them to leave. And therefore, human beings were the actual target all the time. They were the subjects of the war. It was not like, we think of World War II, we've seen the movies. The point was to sort of gain some sort of strategic position, get a bridge, knock down a bridge, or get it to some kind of mountain peak. This was basically the whole purpose of the war, was to destroy homes so as to either kill people or to get them to leave so that you could take the territory. So it really was inevitable. I mean, they were the subject of the war. Nothing else was.
You covered the Vatican for a few decades. The Vatican can be a mysterious, maybe to some secretive place, even to Roman Catholics like myself. How did you try to shed some light, and maybe particularly on scandals in the Catholic Church, such as child sexual abuse?
Well, again, it's thanks to the victims that we were able to tell that story, because we certainly didn't get very much from the institution. I can assure you it's not an easy institution to cover, especially for women, because it's obviously a male-dominated domain. But the sexual abuse crisis was possible precisely because of the victims who came out, who called the church and the priests and their superiors to account. And otherwise, we never would have been able to cover that story.
You reported on the resignation of Pope Benedict XVI 10 years ago. There was no template to follow here. First pontiff to resign in 600 years.
Absolutely. I'm not sure he even knew what he invented some names for himself. He called himself Pope Emeritus. And a lot of people in the Vatican are not sure that will last should there be another resignation. So, everybody was playing by ear. Nobody, we had to go back to get our history books to find out who was the last pope to resign hundreds and hundreds of years before.
Your obit of Benedict after he died at the end of December of last year, one of my favorite stories, because it was a look at the controversial time of this pontiff's. I mean, he offended Jews, Muslims, had to step back or apologize, make amends.
He rehabilitated a Holocaust-denying archbishop, which caused tremendous, tremendous turmoil. Even Angela Merkel, then the chancellor of Germany, his native country, publicly reprimanded the Pope for what he had done. He stepped on a lot of toes. I was on the trip following Benedict when in Germany when he was giving his lecture at Regensburg, where he had a quote that was very, very insulting to Islam, to Muslims, and all sorts of the reactions were worldwide, were furious. There were even some violence in certain parts of the world. Now, he made a lot of mistakes, definitely.
Mm-hmm. You received numerous awards for your coverage of the Civil War in the former Yugoslavia, the war in Kosovo. But I'd like you to tell me maybe one or two of your favorite non-conflict, non-Vatican stories, whether it was the funeral of Luciano Pavarotti or some fun story that you had.
I love doing stories about food, about opera, about, I had a wonderful story of an American priest, a very really eccentric priest. His name was Reginald Foster. He was from Milwaukee, and he was a Latin scholar. He was the official translator of all Latin documents in the Vatican, the Pope's documents, and he was a great teacher. And he would take his students on trips, and I followed him once. We went to what had been the Villa of Cicero, the Roman orator. And that's a great story. It's one of my favorites. He died just a few years ago, and I did a little obit on Reginald Foster. He was quite a character. And those are the stories that are really great fun to do.
You mentioned food. I have to go back to your story about garlic and the great debate in Italy about too much or not enough garlic on the Italian dinner table.
Well, the secret there was because the prime minister at the time, the notorious, infamous Silvio Berlusconi, media mogul tycoon, was known not to like garlic. And that's what the whole thing had started from there. And I assure you, the consensus I found, everybody I interviewed here in Rome certainly thought that it was totally insane. There's no way you could have most Italian cuisine, not most, but a great deal of it without garlic would be senseless.
All right. So I understand one of the next chapters in your career is a book. Will you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, hey, it's a long way off because I have to do still a lot of research. I'm thinking now I think I'd like to write about my father, who was a scholar and a very cosmopolitan person and a translator who really bridged two cultures or more. He spoke many different languages. And he was, an immigrant, an expatriate to the United States, like so many of us were, come from either immigrants, refugees, or expatriates, and I'm one of them. And so it's a story I'd like to tell.
And he fled fascist Italy under Mussolini.
That's correct.
Sylvia, I met you once. It was 25 years ago. At a public radio conference, you were swarmed by a bunch of public radio nerds, not unlike me. And I understand that you were fangirled by then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton when your colleague Michelle Kellerman was introducing you. I wanted to ask you, when people recognize you in public, do they come up to you and try to do their best impression of your sign-off with maybe a bit of an Italian accent?
Well, yes, not always, but I'll tell you somebody who did it and did it very well. When he was no longer in office, was Barack Obama.
Oh, so he rates top stars, 5 stars at least, for your evaluation. Okay, so Sylvia, we're running out of time, but listeners are going to miss your reporting. They're going to miss your voice. Might you do one last sign off for them?
Okay, this is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
Sylvia, thank you so much. Sylvia Poggioli is leaving NPR this week after 41 years. Sylvia, thanks for joining us. But more importantly, thanks so much for your amazing reporting through the years.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Baseball is back. The Pirates open their season tomorrow in Cincinnati. High school baseball and softball have begun, and soon will be time for Little League and Pony League games in our area. But spending cuts at some public schools have reduced free organized sports, while pay-to-play privatized sports are on the rise. A 2020 report from the CDC found the higher a family's income, the more likely youth from that family participated in sports. Amid rising costs of club and private teams, it's no wonder some families might opt out. The Pittsburgh Hardball Academy wants to make baseball and softball accessible to all, regardless of income. Nelson Cooper IV is co-founder and executive director and joins us now. Nelson, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Why is it important for young people, kids, to participate in sports?
I mean, there's many, many positive reasons that kids should participate in sports, but I think our focus of our program is really to make sure that kids, particularly after COVID, are able to get back doing healthy and positive activities. And we think that sports build a lot of lifelong lessons for children that can help them not only get into college, but help them in their adult life as well.
When did you notice this affordability issue when it comes to baseball and softball?
I noticed it growing up. So I'm originally from Seattle. I'm from a single-parent household, and I was able to participate in a program like Pittsburgh Hardball Academy growing up. Without that program, I wouldn't have been able to make it to college, wouldn't have been able to have the professional success, been able to have the Pittsburgh Hardball Academy started here in Pittsburgh and giving back to the community. So that I noticed it as a child, and then once moving to Pittsburgh, kind of really saw the landscape was similar to what I had. So myself and Brian Jacobson, who's from the Pittsburgh community, has been doing community baseball for 30 years. We decided to start hardball to be able to give opportunities to youth in the region.
Obviously, you care about the kids. You also care about baseball. How far up the ladder did you play?
I played through college, so I went to North Carolina Central University, a historically black college in Durham, North Carolina.
And what's your play? Now you got me interested.
I was a third baseman, played third base and first base. I would joke now that I played a lot of the bench as well. That joke wasn't so funny 10 years ago, but now it's kind of funny to look back. But yeah, that was my position.
Well, why has it become so expensive?
I think it's just the youth sports has become a really lucrative business. And I work in banking full time, so I'm all in with capitalism. I understand that business is great, and there's a lot of great opportunities from private lessons, from pay-to-play sports. But unfortunately for that, kids that may not have the means or families that may not have the resources to provide all of those different lessons and travel experiences to their kids just kind of get priced out of the game. So I think really the issue that has happened in youth sports comes to it's a huge business. There's a lot of people in this space and playing, and they're making a lot of money from it. And unfortunately, that leaves some people in the dust. But it does provide opportunities for the people that can't afford it to have amazing experiences as well.
Mm-hmm. In addition to the financial challenges, are there other hurdles that families face specifically in Pittsburgh that might hinder their kids, young adolescents, from playing baseball or softball?
Yeah, I think the one thing that's tough here in Pittsburgh, particularly in the inner cities, the fields for baseball, they're just not really a high level. If you look at some of the suburban communities around us, there's a lot of really high quality fields that they take care of in those communities. In the city of Pittsburgh, the fields just aren't great. The weather here also is prohibitive to playing baseball outside year round. So you need indoor facilities. And of course, indoor facilities come with a cost. So we're happy to have the only indoor facility in the city of Pittsburgh. It's in Shadyside, partnered with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Western Pennsylvania, that is accessible to youth regardless of their background.
So how is the Pittsburgh Hardball Academy trying to address the income inequality, affordability issue?
Yeah, so our program, I would say, is the only program of its type in this region. So we're a year-round program. Our programming season starts in August and goes through the following July. Right now, we have two separate types of programs on the baseball standpoint. We have teams that are for kids that are 14 to 18 years old, and then we have training and development programs for kids that are younger that are trying to get introduced to the game. So this high school, 14 to 18-year-old kids, it's the traditional travel where we're going to tournaments, we do showcases, we train them all year round. Any lodging that they need when they go to the showcases, uniform equipment, anything that they need for baseball is included in our annual fee, which ends up being $75 a month. But as I've said in the past and always say it to people, the cost will never be a barrier to entry for our program. So we have some families that are using scholarships, some families that are unable to pay, and then there's some families that are able to do that. But our annual cost, our annual fee is $900. However, if we put that at a market value, it'd be about $8,500 per kid to go through our program. So it's a huge discount for the kids that are participating, and our teams are very, very diverse because of that.
Your academy focuses on underrepresented population. Who are these folks?
Yeah, so underrepresented is the term that we use specifically to identify financial barriers, to identify potentially single parents, kids with a background that may be non-traditional, and as well as specifically African-American baseball players. And as you see in this past World Series, is the first time since the 40s that there was not, since the color barrier is broken, that there's not an African-American player in the World Series. And so we're addressing that regardless of the income of an African-American student athlete, they're able to participate in our program. And then, as I said, with underrepresented financial barriers or people from background that may have a background that's non-traditional.
So how are players placed on each team? Is it skill? Is it availability? How?
So I wish we could take everyone, but yes, we have tryouts in August. For the most part, we keep almost all of the kids. It's a resource thing, and we're always actively fundraising in order to continue to provide opportunities. Currently, we have over 100 kids. Each of our teams have about 30 kids on the team, and then we have different rosters from each weekend. But it's really open. As I said before, almost 60, 70% of our kids are diverse minorities. But our goal with the organization is not only to train them on the field, but we do academic enrichment, career readiness, and social enrichment to make sure that they're prepared to go to college, which we've had over 30 kids go to college at Division I, Division II, Division III levels, as well as making sure that they're ready for a career. And we're starting to have kids who've come through our program who are getting internship opportunities at local companies.
For younger children who aren't yet eligible to try out for a travel team, what opportunities do you provide for them?
So we have indoor clinics that are available, and you can see it right on our website. Anyone can reach out if they're interested in getting into baseball. Our email address is contact@pittsburghhardball.org, but we have training for them that is open throughout the entire winter.
All right. Now, finally, you also have a program called The Focus, facilitating opportunities for college and universal success for middle school, high school, and young adult participants. Tell us why it's important to offer opportunities outside the baseball field.
I think it's really unique in youth sports that you have a captive audience and you're able to get the kids in with the sport. So while we have that, we're able to take them and introduce them things off the field to make sure that they're successful in life.
And very briefly, you are able to keep the cost down. You were talking about that earlier. How do you do that? Is it volunteer coaches?
We're all volunteers. We're starting to pay coaches for the first time this year, which is nice for them. But we have volunteer staff, but we fundraise. We heavily fundraise, and that's our biggest need. The more that we're able to fundraise, the more opportunities we're going to be able to give to kids in the community.
Nelson Cooper IV is Executive Director and co-founder of the Pittsburgh Hardball Academy. Thanks for your time. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Many people run on Pittsburgh streets, but what about running all of them? 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley spoke with one man who did just that.
Meet Thomas Walter Murphy VII, or
Tom Seven. I'm a computer scientist and artist and runner living in Pittsburgh for more than 20 years now.
Tom came here for Carnegie Mellon University in the 1990s and says back then he felt like he wasn't really exploring the city. So one day he decided to venture further from campus.
I realized there's like a lot to see, a lot of interesting stuff, industrial ruins, history, people that are different from me, beautiful secret views, little hidden parks in the woods. And so that was addicting. And then the I like doing hard things. I like setting myself for something I'm not sure I can succeed at.
In 2006, he set his goal of running every Pittsburgh street and began with a jog through parts of the East End, including Shadyside, Bloomfield, Point Breeze, and Squirrel Hill. As he continued to pursue the project, he set some rules for himself, including running in what he calls expert mode.
And this is where I'm always starting or ending at my home in Shadyside, which meant that as I got to very distant places, I would have to run 20, 30 miles sometimes at a time just to, you know, just to get to new streets, run them, and come back.
Tom says to tackle the roughly 1,500 miles of Pittsburgh streets, he went on 269 runs, totaling 3,663.1 miles. Sometimes if he was on a long run and had already been on a street, he'd allow himself to walk. And if he got injured, he'd take the bus home. He also didn't run in dangerous situations, so highways were usually out of the question.
What is a road is like one of the top topics that I'm thinking about as I'm running, because there's so many things. You know, Pittsburgh has all of these staircases that have street signs. They're fascinating. I love them. And of course, I try to go on those because they're some of the best stuff we've got. But I don't count those as like roads, because sometimes you just can't get on them.
How did he keep track of where he had run? Tom says you have to remember that he started 16 years ago. GPS watches weren't really a thing.
Cell phones. We didn't have cell phones yet. Smartphones. That's how long ago we're talking. So there were not that many options. Google Earth was one of the only packages out there that could show you the whole map and like load a GPS thing from a GPS watch, which is an exotic device.
Eventually, being a computer scientist and whiz at this kind of visualization, Tom says he built his own code. But for any runners who are not computer scientists, he says there are plenty of apps people can download.
And I definitely recommend doing this kind of thing. I mean, it doesn't have to be running. It doesn't have to be expert mode. But exploring the city that you live in is very, very rewarding.
While exploring, Tom says he loved finding things that weren't necessarily on maps, like the abandoned overturned ship on the Allegheny River, or hidden trails that led to spectacular views. You can see some of these sites and other adventures in a YouTube video he made. The full map and all of his runs are there, and he goes into some other peculiarities about the city, including encountering trap streets. These are fake streets placed into maps by map makers.
This don't bother you if you're looking for directions. You're like, I'm not going to go on this little dead end. I don't care. But if you're trying to run all the streets, then you find that they're not there. But the idea is that if someone copies the map and they copy this fake street, then you know that they copied off you. So those are a constant annoyance.
After 16 years and about 20 pairs of sneakers, Tom completed his final run in 2022. As for advice for people who want to start their own big projects?
I think my number one piece of advice though is get yourself in a little over your head, right? So making a commitment like to your friends, hey, I'm going to do this thing. Then they're going to give you a little bit of a hard time if you don't.
Yes, he acknowledges that running is hard, but he says physical activity is important.
I feel more productive in my intellectual tasks when I'm keeping a good, you know, like when I'm not sedentary. So do both.
You can watch Tom's full video at WESA.FM. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, many of our servicemen and women come home suffering from traumatic brain injury or PTSD. Now there's an effort to build a facility to raise and train dogs to service these veterans. Thanks to our team, Emma Furry, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Till next time, hope you have a good day of good news.